Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our July.
It is July.
Native Location Club. We're sponsored by MAB and Community Services. We have our speaker today, John. I don't remember your last.
Corrigan.
I should be able to remember that. I mean, there's a sign, a song almost like that.
H.
Oh, double R I.
Yeah.
Harrington.
Harrington.
He was running for office, wasn't he, at one time?
Yeah.
Oh, please don't equate me with any sort of underbellied politician.
No, that was a long time ago.
Okay, all right, as long as it was a long time ago. I see this Cahill character speak on TV and I squirm.
John is a weather historian and he's going to give us some very interesting facts. Things that happened in this neck of the woods. So if you want to take it over, Sean.
Thank you very much. Today's lecture is the Great Middlesex Tornado. I often call this the second great tornado of Massachusetts, the first being the Worcester Tornado of June of 1953. My name is John Horrigan. It's a pleasure to be here for the Reading Low Vision Group. And if we have time, I may have some comments about the year without a summer. Now, you probably think that I'm talking about this 2009, I'm talking about 18 and 16, but I will parallel it with some comments about this dismal weather we've been having. I think it's that you're seeing a change of a weather pattern for the next couple of years in New England. That's my own personal opinion, and I'm only basing it on historical data extracted from this area over the past 350 years. Another lecture on another day, but today the Great Middlesex Tornado. A tornado that struck eastern Massachusetts on August 22nd in the year of 1851. I'm a historical fire researcher, a historical astronomer, a historical economist, and a historical weather researcher as well. Come on in. Yes, absolutely. Come on in. We just started.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'm called an old New England folklorist. What that means is I don't have a prefix before my name, a suffix following my name, or a mortgage-sized student loan following me around. I think the people are finally realizing that the colleges have a racket going where they give you a degree and they give you a student loan that you can never, ever pay off. When I say I've been called a lot of things, and this is an adult crowd, but I've been called a rogue nostalgic, an infotainer, a pocket historian, a non-academic storyteller, and basically my agenda is the new popular public history. I bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. And I've collected virtually every account of North American, Anglo-Saxon historical, meteorological, and seismological events from 1492 through 1938. And if you hear me break out into an announcer's voice, that's because one of my professions is I'm a professional hockey announcer and basketball announcer. Cell phones off, please. Usually as soon as I ask that, mine rings. So I'm going to reach into my pocket and ensure that it's off. I always have the adage, there's always someone in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do. And, of course, someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. So I deal with both accordingly. So what are we going to talk about this morning about this great West Cambridge tornado, the great Middlesex County tornado, the great Middlesex tornado? It's got about four monikers. We're going to talk about the year 1851. We're going to talk about the day of August 22nd, 1851 in eastern Massachusetts. We'll look at the accounts of the tornado, the track of the tornado, something I call apples to apples, the aftermath, the other great Middlesex tornado, the first Anglo-Saxon American tornado, water spouts, and some recent severe thunderstorms in the area. And I think we just got walloped yesterday, didn't we? Did you get some good thunder up here in Reading?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. A lot of lightning in that one. Violent thunderstorm. Year 1851. Well, what happened during that year? January 23rd. The flip of a coin determines whether a new city in the Oregon Territory is named after Boston, Massachusetts, or Portland, Maine. Who won?
Portland.
You got it. March 27th. The first reported case of Anglo-Saxons seeing Yosemite Valley. I'm saying Anglo-Saxons because the Native Americans were here 1,000 years before us. And then June 21st, 1851, it's called the greatest chess match ever. surpassing Fischer Spassky. The Immortal Game was a chess match played by Adolf Anderson and Lionel Kieseritzky. It was a rivalry similar to Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer. The bold sacrifices made by Anderson to finally secure victory made it one of the most famous chess games of all time. He gave up both of his rooks and his queen, checkmating his opponent with three remaining minor pieces. It's been called an achievement perhaps unparalleled in chess literature. And of course, on August 22, 1851, the first America's Cup yacht race was held, with the yacht America winning. And don't worry about the, is that focused on the screen there, folks? I don't have my glasses on, and
yes.
Can you tell me if that's, let's just ensure that, how's that?
It's fine.
Okay, good. Don't worry about reading the text on the screen, I'll drive the narration from here. So, here's a trivia question. The president in 1851, hint, he was the last member of the Whig Party to be elected president. Anyone? That's his photograph. Millard Fillmore, 13th president of the United States of America. So no one could remember him in this room, and no one could remember him in American history, so don't feel bad. Where do I get my information? Well, I get my accounts from Reverend Charles Brooks of West Medford. West Medford then became the town of Arlington. A leader in public education, he wrote the pamphlet, The Tornado of 1851. William Blasius of Cambridge, I'll be drawing on his accounts a lot. He's a scientist without portfolio, extensive study of the track of the tornado, the destruction, and the meteorological phenomena associated with it. He wrote an article called Storms, Their Nature, Classification, and Laws. I'll be drawing from the accounts of Professor Henry L. Eustace of Harvard College. He wrote The Tornado of August 22, 1851. Charles Sims Parker, author of The Town of Arlington, Past and Present, 1907. My favorite, David McWilliams Ludlum, author of Early American Tornadoes. Sidney Perley, who has a marvelous book called Historic Storms of New England. And due to the dense population of the area in which this tornado passed, this was the most closely observed tornado in American history up to that point. Remember, we're just having wagon trains go across the Midwest. Let's talk about William Blasius. He's an intellectual who migrated to America after political revolution in Germany in 1848. He was not an accredited professor. So he was fishing at Fresh Pond a few minutes before the tornado passed, only a few hundred yards to the north of that small body of water. But he had taken shelter from the approaching thundercloud and did not actually witness the event, much to his chagrin. His lecture in Concord in February 1852, several months after the tornado, was attended by none other than author, philanthropist, Henry David Thoreau. Quote, this is what Thoreau said, and again, he's, on one day I love this guy, the next day I can't stand him, but he's a rock star of this period, there's no doubt about it in America. And he says, quote, the audience never tired of hearing how far the wind carried some man, woman, or child, or family Bible, but they are immediately tired if you undertake to give them a scientific account of it. Judge Parmenter, and we have to ask the question, was it really a tornado? Well, Judge Parmenter, author of Middlesex County History, late 19th century, he says, quote, those who saw it described it as a dark cloud sweeping over the surface of the country with frightful speed, its base now touching the earth and now bounding up for a little to return farther on. Its shape was variously compared to a spreading elm, an upright column, an hourglass, and an inverted cone. So there are different vantage points that offer diverse descriptions. Quote, a witness described it as an elephant's trunk waving from side to side and sucking up everything that came in its way and 30 to 50 rods. In some areas, the swath of destruction was over, a rod is 16 and a half feet, so you're talking 500 feet to almost 800 feet wide, the swath of destruction. Let's look at the day, the calm before the storm. Friday, August 22nd, 1851, was a hot, sultry day. A light southwest wind had been blowing for most of the day, but it died away as the dark bank of clouds moved in. At 4:30 in the afternoon, there was a perfect calm. Reverend Brooks, quote, It was peculiar. Many spoke of a dead closeness, a remarkable want of elasticity in the air. Many complained of lassitude from this cause. Lassitude is weariness. So the calm before the storm, William Blatius says, quote, "The air was calm, sultry, and oppressive. Not the slightest breeze was blowing, not a leaf moving. A death-like stillness prevailed around us in nature. While clouds grew up on the western horizon and nearly reached the zenith in an enormous thunderhead. At 4 o'clock, an old sea captain told his wife, 'If I was at sea, I should expect to see a waterspout.' Temperatures measured between 75 degrees Fahrenheit and 80 degrees Fahrenheit, and mid-afternoon showed a falling barometer with fair skies and a southwesterly wind flow. David Ludlam said that it was a stagnant air mass of moisture-laden tropical air over southern New England, with cool polar air, a cold front, moving southward over Vermont and New Hampshire. You have two large fronts slamming headlong into each other, and that's what gives you this dangerous front, this dangerous storm. So the central line of march for this tornado seemed to be west-southwest to east-southeast. The track of the tornado. Well, what about the topography? It tracked through woods and plains, hills and valleys, villages and cultivated fields. We all know the topography of eastern Massachusetts, and you have dells, no big mountains with the exception of the Blue Hills in Milton. Aside from homes, fences and chimneys were destroyed. Some trees were flattened, whereas adjacent trees remained unscathed, which is always peculiar with a tornado. Some cornfields looked as though they had been rolled over by a heavy press. The axis line lay between North 60 East and North 70 East. It was measured and staked every 100 feet during a post-storm survey and analysis by Henry Eustace. Essentially, this tornado followed modern-day Route 60. So where did the track of the tornado go? It began in the Quinsigamond area of Worcester and then tracked eastward to Wayland, Weston, Waltham, Belmont, West Cambridge, a.k.a. Arlington, Medford, Malden, Lynn, Swampscott, Rockport. And the question is, did it actually blow out to sea? What about the breadth of the monster? Well, it was different widths at different areas. And I'm going to harken back to the rods measurement. And again, each rod is 16 and a half feet. So 16 and a half feet, 10 rods is 160 feet. 20 is about 330 feet. At Mystic River, it was 71 rods wide. At Lowell Railroad Depot, 60 rods wide. At Mrs. Porter's house, and again, we'll be going over these, 56 rods wide. Miss Brooks' house, 54 rods wide. Dr. Kidder's house at the Andover Turnpike, 54 rods wide. Mr. Swan's and Mr. Hall's land, 53 rods wide. And it was only 6 yards wide at its conception in Waltham, which is 20 to 40 yards wide in Medford at its terminus. And what about the lightning? Well, let me tell you, the lightning was vivid and fierce. There was a report of a melted lightning rod in West Medford and several other charred lightning rods along the tornado's course. What about this course of what I call the buzzsaw? Well, it hit the premises of James Brown on the Waltham line and swept across it, ripping up orchards, woods, and cornfields. It traversed Pleasant Street to the Belmont line and tore across the land of Captain Hopkins, Dr. Wellington, and other residents on the eastern side of that street. It then raced across the northeast corner of Spy Pond, demolishing ice houses on the water's edge, crossed the highway near Franklin Street, destroying a store, a schoolhouse, and some dwellings. It then zigzagged through Arlington and hit the Lowell Railroad Depot, crossed the Mystic River about 50 rods below the Ware Bridge in Medford. So the path, and again, I apologize if you can't see it, but basically this map shows some arrows that are traveling from just east of Worcester to Malden, which if we look at in your area here in Reading, it's traveling just to the north of your area, actually just to the south of your area, I'm sorry. So we're south of here. And you're going to see that I'm going to extract some map, cull some images from the map by Henry L. Eustace. It's called The Tornado of August 22nd, 1851, published in 1855. It covers the track from Wellington Hill in Waltham to the Mystic River.
So the tornado is born in Worcester. It began in Quinsigamond Village, eastern Worcester, about 27 miles west of Waltham, sometime around 4:30 in the afternoon. So we're looking at 0 hour at about 4:30 p.m. And that's when most tornadoes are born. The Worcester tornado was born at about 5 o'clock. Crops were flattened, roofs were torn off, and trees were uprooted. Many felt an odd stillness in the air just prior to the, what they say, quote, the blast of the angry zephyr. And then it went on to wailing, quote, the heavens sparked. Severe showers, and then an extraordinary flash of lightning in what I call the wailing and wailing. Residents thought that a building had been struck as a very dark cloud described as a dense black column of what appeared to be smoke rose very rapidly, 1 mile in height. It looked like an inverted elm or hourglass. So they think it's a fire, a house struck by a fire. That's the tornado. Waltham. It came from the hill. A long roll of thunder came just after 2 o'clock from the northwest. A very large black bank of clouds rose to the height of 50 degrees, stretching from west-southwest to east-northeast. The first full force of the whirlwind struck at Prospect Hill, which is a 482-foot eminence east of modern-day Route 128 and north of the Route 20 interchange near Route 117. According to Professor Eustace, quote, it came from the hill. Emerging from a thicket of forest growth near the foot of Wellington Hill, Lexington, and Bacon Streets in Waltham, the storm crosses an open meadow and commences the ascent of the hill. Then it passes along the crest of the hill, meeting in its way houses and barns, orchards, cornfields, fences, and forests. In the eye of the tornado, you can clearly see Boston from atop Wellington Hill. So it came from the hill with attitude. And if you can see this map, good. If you can't, don't worry about it. Basically, it's showing you a circle with an arrow, and the arrow indicates which direction the wind is blowing. It's almost as if you took the minute hand from a clock and pointed it in all odd directions. That's the direction of the wind in this particular tornado. Unpredictable. Well, the wind whipped up as it came across Wellington Hill and Trapelo Road. A dozen wind directions happened on 1 acre of land at the base of Prospect Hill. So this thing had had cyclonic movement to it, and it started ripping up the ground and anything in its path. There were assorted losses in Waltham. The buildings of Robert Baldwin and Sons were badly damaged, as a portion of the roofs of both the house and the barn were carried away with two or three sheds. Several hives of bees were destroyed along with their honey. The bees themselves took immediate possession of the elder Mr. Baldwin's house, whose residents were compelled to beat a retreat. They're stupid bees. Get out of that house. We'll take this. The Baldwins lost many valuable fruit trees with other crops. Their loss is estimated at not less than $1,000. That's $1,000. The money you're going to hear is $1,851. $1,000 today, you're talking about $125,000. The dwelling house of Mr. Nathan Lawrence was partly unroofed, and the shed attached to it was turned completely around. And incidentally, what we're talking about, we're seeing a lot of orchards in the 1850s in eastern Massachusetts, okay, fruit orchards. And what was one of the best exports? Apples. Exactly. And what do you get out of apples?
Cider.
And boy, they made great cider in New England. It was known around the world. Had a little edge to it, if you know what I mean, ladies and gentlemen. A part of the roof of Mr. Lawrence's new barn was carried away, and the backside was blown out. Mr. Lawrence lost nearly all of his fruit trees. His loss may be estimated at about $500. Again, you're talking about 10x, 10.5x. So you're talking near $70,000. Mr. Sullivan Wellington, a tenant to Mr. Lawrence, lost a quantity of hay blown out of the barn. Also a lot of salt hay, which lay in heaps in the field, with the whole of his fruit crop estimated at about $200. Mr. Sawyer had two sheds carried away with considerable other damage estimated at $300. So this poor man suffered $4,000 in damage. You're talking almost $6 million in today's dollars. By the time the thing left Waltham, Waltham would sustain $4,000 worth of damages, but there was considerable damage to orchards and other trees. Fruit and crops were lost as far as North Street. And of course, another popular crop in New England is corn. I'm trying to grow corn. One of the migrant workers that came to cut the lawn the other day doesn't understand English, lopped off all my corn thinking it was grass that needed trimming. You ever hear those leaf blowers too? There goes my garden. Mr. Sawyer had two of his sheds carried away. The tornado then pursued a course across a rock meadow and slammed into the Kendall estate. It moved just north of Beaver Brook Reservation and crossed at the junction of Route 2 and Pleasant Street. Now, quote, according to Professor Eustace, quote, now it commences its descent and, as if gathering fresh strength at each obstacle, flies with resistless violence throughout the town beneath, that's Belmont, bathes its weary wings in the waters of Spy Pond, cools its feverish breath by the demolition of an ice house, and with renewed vigor speeds its way through the heart of West Cambridge over the plain to the Mystic River. Professor Eustace, Longfellow, you ain't my friend. Trying to be poetic there. Question is, was there a water spout at Spy Pond? As the vortex crossed Spy Pond, a column of water more than 100 feet high, mixed with dust from the roadway and gravel from the railroad embankment, was raised from the surface, and two ice houses on the shore were demolished. In one of the ice houses was a man with a horse and a carriage. As the storm began, the horse panicked and started out of the building, dragging the man. As it did, the carriage was crushed by falling timbers. Both the horse and the man were uninjured. Colonel Douglas of Cambridgeport, who was sailing on the pond with two friends, had his boat lifted into the air perpendicularly by the waterspout, but saved his life by clinging to a tree on the nearby shore. No word of his friends, but... Everything in the vicinity, including several boys playing on the shore, were plastered in mud and water, gravelly-type mud. And the boys, uninjured in their fleeting elation, asked if it might happen again just one more time. And of course, Spy Pond was known to harvest ice prior to the refrigerators. So it's on to West Cambridge. And we're ripping it up at Brown's Orchard. At West Cambridge, Brown's farm had $850 worth of damage. Brown's farm, with a tenant, Fogg, who was also renting out a barn, had $250 worth of damage. In West Cambridge, William Hill's farm had $750 worth of damage. Only the southerly side of his trees and his wall were caked in mud. So at that point, we know which direction the wind was blowing. We know what the force of the zephyr. In West Cambridge, Thaddeus Frost's farm suffered $440 worth of damage. His pear and apple trees were destroyed, and his cucumber patch. In West Cambridge, Daniel Hill's family farm suffered $500 worth of damage, including his watermelon patch. In West Cambridge, Timothy Swan lost 75 apple trees, 8 peach trees, 5 cherry trees, and 2 pear trees, and a partridge in that pear. No. And the cost was $940. Fessenden and Whittemore's large grocery and dry goods store was leveled. Gershom Whittemore, proprietor, was in the store at the time of the tornado. He was buried in the ruins. He arose dazed and cut and bruised. Overall, the Fessenden and Whittemore families lost $3,452.50. So you're saying almost $500,000 in today's dollars. In the middle of Mr. Henry Whittemore's house in West Cambridge, in the second story, there's a door in whose top are 6 small panes of glass. The door is exactly opposite the front window, which was blown in during the tornado. Before the 6 panes of glass hung a white cloth curtain. Through this curtain was a small ragged hole not larger than a pea. Directly behind this hole, the pane of glass is perforated, and a hole is left almost as large as a half dollar. This hole in the glass was nearly round, and its edges, instead of being sharp as broken glass, seems to be melted into roundness. Moreover, for a quarter of an inch around the edges of this hole, there's a thin, wavy layer of apparently melted glass. A few cracks in the glass ray off from the center of the hole. And since the tornado, a piece of glass which was loose has been taken out, thus destroying, so far, the circular form of the hole and the wavy layers which bounded into it. This is by Reverend Brooks. What he's basically saying is he finds this hole the size of a pea on one side, and it goes in one end window and out another the size of a half dollar, and it looks as though a bullet's been shot through as it's melted. John Fowle lost his store and $1,100. The damage to the center schoolhouse was $124. It worked over Arlington. Oaks, maples, walnuts from 2 to 2.5 feet in diameter, huge, beautiful trees, were snapped like straws. It passed through Arlington from west-southwest to the east-northeast, causing $23,606 worth of damages. It then crossed Alewife Brook at Tufts University. As it moved towards Medford, the cyclone intensified. It hit Medford, and here's where we have our casualties. For some reason, even though it's more of an urban area than the towns in which it preceded, Medford got it but good. And then the menace cometh. As it crossed the Meeting House Brook and then the Andover Turnpike, which is old Route 28 and not part of I-93, and you're all children of Route 28, the vortex exhibited a power in the elements never witnessed before by the oldest inhabitants of this region, according to Professor Henry Eustace. Can anybody see this pictorial? This is the famous rendering. It appeared in Gleason's pictorial only a couple of weeks after the great Medford tornado of 1851. This appeared on September 13th. Can anybody see that? Okay. What I want to point out is there's a man. This just gives you the full intensity of the whirlwind. There's a man clinging to a fence post here. And there's another image. This is an 1851 rendering of what they called, quote, the horrors of the whirlwind throughout New England. People getting covered in timber. And you're going to see that account in just a moment. I call it the menace of method. Evidence that the funnel lifted and then skipped at times, as only tops of roofs and trees displayed damage. So this is a skipper. Some insist that there was no time to react as the whirlwind was right upon them, traveling over 50 miles per hour. The only death of the tornado occurred in Medford. And in West Medford, a part of the roof of Mr. Lane's barn and several feet of lead pipe from Reverend Pierpont's house were carried more than 500 feet directly across its track. And many trees and other objects, apparently in the midst of the current, were left untouched, while others on its extreme verge were swept away. I call this the Medford blowout. The track of the wind here went from 40 to 76 rods wide, so it definitely the breadth of this monster increased, almost doubling. It caused $18,768 worth of damage in Medford. I'm talking almost $20 million. It passed through the northern part of Medford near the railroad depot. It demolished several houses, barns, and other buildings. A two-story brick building was destroyed. And then what I call Mr. West moves northwest. Mr. West, who was building a house for a Mr. Haskins in Medford, saw it coming from West Cambridge. As soon as he saw it destroy a house adjacent to the Lowell Railroad Depot, he sprang from the house and ran for his life, hiding behind a wall only 4 or 5 rods distant. When he did, the house behind him was destroyed. Both houses were destroyed in 5 or 6 seconds. Reverend Brooks thinks that it's the end of the world. Quote, this is what he says. I was in my sister's house at the time, saw it but an instant before it struck the house. I rushed to lock the front door, and at the moment we felt the first shock, I cried out violently to the family that it was all over. I opened the door and sprang upon the bank over which its center had just passed and looked for it. It had gone at least a mile before I could reach the place, though the distance from the house was not 3 rods. It seemed to me but a breath of time, and now, after reviewing the facts, I cannot persuade myself that its speed at that place was less than 50 miles per hour. Miss Brooks's place got walloped. One witness says she saw the large barn owned by Miss Brooks rise into the air and then fall in ruins. There's evidence yet remaining that this large barn, built of heavy timber and plank, was taken up and then carried 15 feet before it was torn to pieces. That according to Reverend Charles Brooks. Where'd the roof go? The roof of Miss Brooks's house was seen to go thus, and although every beam and rafter went with it, we have not yet been able to find even a shingle of it, though we have searched thorough 3 miles, according to Reverend Brooks. And there goes the tree. A tree of very large size in Miss Brooks's orchard was decapitated, and the trunk now stands erect, but the top was taken up and carried off and has never been found, according to Reverend Brooks. And there goes another one. In Miss Brooks's garden, the trees, to the number of 50 or more, lie oddly. A locust tree, 9 1/4 rods from the center, points northwest, while a cherry tree that lies upon it points south-southeast. 1 rod south of center, a cherry tree points northeast by east. So trees are broken off and uprooted, and they're pointed in all different directions, according to Reverend Brooks. Brooks continues here with this fusillade of missiles. Shingles and boards and rafters and slates, which are known to have belonged to certain houses, were found 2 or 3 miles from their original places. Boy, did Doc Kidder get it, but good. Reverend Charles Brooks, quote, "A thick, strong brick wall was thrown down 10 feet from its foundation. Some of the bricks carried to a great distance. A pine tree, 10 inches in diameter, was broken off, then carried some 100 feet into the air, and then thrown through the roof and the window of Dr. Kidder's house. His lightning rods were much bent." How'd you like them apples? Quote, Reverend Brooks, "Near Mystic River and Weir Bridge, a field of 75 acres stand apple trees, unmoved and uninjured, while all their nearest neighbors lie prostrate and broken." Some got it, some didn't. "There are many who thought that the apples lying upon the ground at the time were baked on their south side by the heat in the wind. That most apples so situated among us were found so baked is true. But whether the sun had not previously done this according to his usual action in the midsummer drought is what we leave others to decide. No one who was in the wind felt any baking heat during its passage." That according to Henry Eustis. I do want to interject here that in this year 1851, it was in a very tumultuous period of weather in New England. This year alone, 1851, you saw the New England Lighthouse Storm on April 21st, which hit, it was a nor'easter, a winter storm, believe it or not, that toppled the original Minot Sledge Lighthouse off the coast of Cohasset, killing the two lightkeepers. Also, in October of this year, after the storm, was something known as the Yankee Gale, which scoured the northeast coast all the way up to Nova Scotia and decimated the entire fishing fleets of Gloucester and Nova Scotia that would go out to George's Bank. The fish catch that year was very, very slim. That winter was tough. And also, there was a drought going on in the summer. So it was a real bad year, 1851. Charles Brooks, Reverend Charles Brooks, says, quote, "In Mr. Hastings' orchard, south of his house, on the banks of the Mystic River, stood a large old apple tree. This tree was 74 1/2 rods south-southeast of what seemed to be the other outer southern edge of the tornado. Nevertheless, it was beheaded, split, and lies pointing exactly east. 100 trees in its immediate vicinity were equally exposed, but yet remained untouched." So you got one tree plucked out of nowhere, snapped in half, and the other trees, nothing. William Blasius, quote, "A large horse chestnut tree near the brook in Mr. Usher's land was decapitated, leaving only a few small limbs attached to the lower part of the trunk. Within a week after the tornado, the buds on these limbs began to swell. New leaves soon appeared, and then blossoms, so that on the 16th of September, 25 days after its decapitation, it displayed 10 or 12 full-grown blossoms." The Flying Boxcar, Reverend Charles Brooks, quote, "A freight car, which was standing upon the side of the track of the Lowell Railroad near the depot, was driven upon that track 165 feet and then taken up and carried 60 feet east, nearly at right angles to to the track. A huge locomotive weighing several tons is lifted up like it's a toy. And when we go to Ware Bridge, it crossed the Mystic River 50 rods south of Ware Bridge, a high wooden bridge crossing the Middlesex Canal. It was exposed, apparently, to the full sweep of the gust, but not moved or damaged. More wonderful yet, at the side of this bridge was a small wooden bathhouse, so light that three men might carry it away, and so frail that one might think that a Chinese fan applied with high energy might blow it over. But this building stands untouched, though nearer the center than its bridge. So you got this little shack near the bridge, and according to Reverend Brooks, nothing. Anybody know where this drawing comes from if you can see it? This is a sketch of a famous movie involving a tornado. It was 1939. What was that answer?
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz is correct. The roof of Mr. Sanford's shed at the Lowell Railroad Depot, though a few feet north of the center, it was thrown 25 or 30 feet northeast and rested at the foot of a tree which pointed east by south. The slates from this roof were separated from it probably while at its greatest elevation, and at that moment, being near the center, they were broken and carried as destructive missiles in every direction. I found some of them a mile distance from their starting point, as Professor Henry Eustace. Assorted losses in West Medford. Total losses, $18,768.1851. The Medford schoolhouse fence, gone. Many fruit and ornamental trees. Hay, carriages, wagons, houses, furniture, fences. The biggest loser was Charles Rollins. He lost two unfinished houses. Damage, $5,770. The late Jonathan Brooks lost $1,632. Samuel Teal Jr. lost $1,181. The Boston Lowell Railroad lost a freight car. And there's that wig again. Remember this guy? Right?
Fillmore.
That's right, Fillmore. In a small room, just 4 rods south of Medford Center, was an engraved likeness of President Fillmore pasted strongly upon a rough plastered wall. Around it were many other engravings of like size. This room was so situated that the wind came in at a west door and went out in an east window. The wind selected His Excellency's head, took it from the wall without tearing it or soiling it in the least, and having carried it through an open window and transported it more than a quarter of a mile. It was deposited in the garden of a friend who returned it safely to again be fastened in its original place. Casualties of Medford. 7 people were injured. Thomas Huffmaster, a German farmer, lost his life while occupied in closing his house against the storm. He was struck by part of the roof of a neighbor's barn on his head, which was driven through the side of his house. He was taken up insensible and so continued till his death about 30 hours later. James S. Sanford, an 18-year-old son of the depot master of the Lowell Railroad, lost both of his feet. The house in which he lived was dislodged from its foundation, and as he was leaving the barn, moving towards the house, he was thrown down, and the building came crashing down upon his feet. He lay under the timbers for 3/4 of an hour. They were both found so badly crushed as to require amputation on the spot, one above the knee and the other just above the ankle, which was successfully performed the same evening at Mass General, and he recovered. So actually it happened at Mass General. Other casualties of Medford. A person in the employment of James M. Usher had his arm broken. A stranger was badly injured in the head by the falling limb of a tree, but he recovered. Mrs. Nutter, wife of H.T. Nutter, was at the time confined to her house by illness. She was in her chamber. In an instant, the roof and most of the house was carried away, including the ceiling and 2 sides of the room where she was occupied, leaving her entirely unsheltered. The bedstead on which she was lying was torn apart and a beam fell on it, yet she escaped with only a very slight injury. A man and a horse were lifted, whirled around, and then set down about 100 yards away, uninjured. A mechanic at work in the attic of an unfinished building, which was wholly demolished, fell with the house, but received only a slight cut on his head. A Mrs. Caldwell, standing in her doorway in her house on a hill, was carried aloft over the tops of trees and deposited safely by the side of a neighbor's barn 500 feet away, suffering only minor bruises and, quote, such was the suddenness of the force in motion that she can give but an imperfect account of her aerial excursion, according to Reverend Brooks. The three most seriously hurt people were taken at once by the Lowell Railroad to the Massachusetts General Hospital, where they not only had the benefit of the best professional skill in the country, but received attentions and comforts without charge. Tell that to your HMO today. A stone wall, 3.5 feet tall, was leveled to the ground. The stones were scattered a rod or two on each side, and Luke Costello had a shoulder injured by one of these flying stones. George Maxwell was hit in the head and had his skull fractured. Timothy Fagan's house was unroofed, his wife's ribs badly jammed by her body being crowded into an opening in one side of the house. A woman was sitting with her child in her lap when the house shook, the roof popped off, exposed in the sky. She was hit by a falling beam, and then her infant was only slightly injured in the neck. And the death of a cyclone. So we know that it lifted in northern Walden, separating into two masses halfway between the earth and the cloud above. The upper part dissipated, and the lower half, an irregular mass, soon disappeared. The heavy wind continued as the microburst now veered north. Inland, at a place called Wood End, a boat was blown out of a pond. A large brush heap carried several rods and apple trees, 8 inches or 10 inches in diameter, were ripped up. As it hit Swampscott, it made a terrific noise. It uprooted several trees, moved a house off its foundation, ripped a porch off a house, and scattered pots and kettles. At Rockport, it knocked down trees and forced the tide into a considerable height. And I'm asking, is this storm surge? And it damaged many stores and property. So the aftermath, according to William Blasius, quote, I could scarcely believe my eyes. Large orchards were completely destroyed. Oaks and maple trees, 2 and 2.5 feet in diameter, broke. Others, twisted like rope at an angle of 180 degrees or more. Still others uprooted and carried in a mutilated state 40 or 50 paces distant. A great number of houses in West Cambridge and Medford were unroofed, and the debris was carried 50 to 100 paces away. Things were taken up into the air and not beaten down. Trees generally resisted the disintegration caused by the winds, but buildings were racked or shattered. A cornfield in Medford revealed the motion of two separate cyclonic circles of wind, one clockwise, the other counterclockwise, almost playing into each other like cogwheels. Thousands came the following days to gawk and loot. That's the path of your tornado. The other great Middlesex tornado that I briefly want to tell you about took place almost 20 years to the day. August 28th, 1871, a Sunday night, this was a rare late-night tornado. It struck at 10:50 p.m. Arlington took the brunt of it. Judge Parmenter, and he was involved in the 1851 tornado, lost his windows at his house on Russell Street. The spire of the Orthodox Congregational Church on Pleasant Street was blown down, turning end over end. Only the vane was damaged, and the bell was found intact 20 feet from the spire. Wind began blowing continuously from the southwest at sunset. As the Unitarian Church struck its bell at 11 o'clock, it was blown off into the street. A noble elm that grew during two centuries near the Adams homestead in Arlington was lost. And I want to tell you about the first tornado ever recorded in Anglo-Saxon history. What I'm talking about is the white man. It's June 15th, 1643. That's New Style calendar. That's the Gregorian calendar, not the Julian calendar. When the calendar was adjusted from the Julian calendar, adapted by Julius Caesar, to the Gregorian calendar, adapted by Pope Gregory, there's no such thing as the dates September 3rd through September 12th, 1752. Those dates were removed from the calendar. So if somebody tells you something about that, say, no, those dates, there's no such thing. That's how they corrected the calendar. Quote, this is according to John Winthrop, who lived from 1588 to 1649. He was a four-term governor. He held on to that job like a pope, like this guy they call Menino in Boston, 1630 to 1649, end quote. There arose a sudden gust at northwest, so violent for half an hour, as it blew down multitudes of trees. It lifted up their meeting house at Newbury, the people being in it. It darkened the air with dust, yet through God's great mercy it did no hurt, but only killed one Indian with the fall of a tree. So it didn't hurt anybody, but it did kill an Indian. It was straight between Lynn and Hampton. And just, I'm up to this thing about water spouts. They're rare tornadoes that are seen off the coast of Florida. Well, eyewitnesses said that this thing crossed Spy Pond as a water spout. Another eyewitness said it crossed Alewife Brook near Tufts University. Just before it slammed into Medford Center, it scaled the Mystic River, and two men were blown completely across the river. Many insisted that it lifted when it blew out to sea after it crossed the Lineway at the Saugus River. Just some other things concerning freshwater water spouts. Inland water spouts have been observed over Lake Tahoe, the Great Salt Lake, and Peru's Lake Titicaca. Water spouts occur most frequently in the Great Lakes during the months of August, September, and October, when the lake waters are near their annual maximum temperature. Great Lakes water spouts formation typically occur when cold Arctic air moving across the waters set up a large temperature difference between the warm surface water layer and the overriding cold air. These spouts tend to last from about 2 to 20 minutes. They move along at speeds of 18 to 28 kilometers per hour, or about 11 to 17 miles per hour. And this one on the screen is a series of water spouts that struck Lake Huron in 1999. And the Florida Keys spawn the most saltwater water spouts in the world. And just if you can see this, the most famous Massachusetts water spout is known as the Martha's Vineyard water spout. This took place on August 19, 1896, the Great Water Spout in Vineyard Sound. I don't know if you can see it, but it was taken in, off of Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. It formed from a thunderstorm on the junction of Vineyard and Nantucket Sounds. It moved from Oak Bluffs towards Vineyard Haven. The funnel cloud formed, and then it dissolved three times, though an invisible vortex still raised salt spray. The funnel cloud was the largest on its second appearance when it was vertical, and it formed a pillar 3,600 feet in height. At the cloud base, it was 840 feet wide, in the middle 144 feet wide, and at sea level 240 feet wide. The cascade was 720 feet wide, with the, that's the diameter of the actual vortex. And the spray raised to, rose to 420 feet. That was taken by measurements. And then finally, we're talking about violent thunderstorms. I'm showing a photograph taken a year ago, this just a little over a year ago, in Newton, June 27, 2008, something known as a microburst, which is a super intense thunderstorm on the verge of a tornado. There were violent, intense thunderstorms just as there were yesterday, which was July 8, 2009, and they rumbled through Waltham, Watertown, and Newton. Multiple lightning strikes, heavy wind gusts up to 57 miles per hour, and power was lost to 20,000 people. There was pea-sized hail. And one of the great things we have is this thing called the internet. The internet promises a lot of things and delivers on only a few.
Okay.
But what they do give you is they give you up to the second weather readings. No longer, folks, do we have to hear a mixture of sun and clouds, partly sunny, partly cloudy. We may see the sun peek through some clouds. There's a chance of thunderstorms. Come out and say it already. Show me the radar map. Oh, that's all I've been hearing is a mixture of sun and clouds, partly cloudy, partly sunny. Oh. So I just want to show you some hail. Hail in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Look at this. Ankle-deep snow, it looks like. This is hail last June, the 24th of June, 2008. It's snow. Yeah, it does look like snow. And that's basically it. Pawtucket was hurt. So that's my talk today on the Great Middlesex Tornado. And as I mentioned, on June 9th, 1953, at about 3:30 in the afternoon, I'd argue it's later than that, a tornado began 46 miles to the west of Worcester, and in 80 minutes, 94 people were dead and 1,400 injured. It was called the Worcester tornado. Does anybody have a story that they can recall that day? I'm looking around, and I don't see if anybody was around in 1953, unfortunately, on this room. So.
1953.
Yes, 1953, the Worcester tornado. Does anybody have any personal accounts?
My husband went to that tornado. He was a fireman here, and they sent the Reading firemen
wow.
to help. And the day, a couple of days after, he drove myself and my daughter out to see the damage.
Wow. Well, yeah. Does anybody else recall that day, 1950?
Yeah, my mother-in-law, to be, lived in Natick, and she was, 8 or 10 miles from the tornado in Southborough or Fayetteville that night. And she sat in her... looked out the window and saw shingles flying and landing in her yard, and she thought, oh, I'm going to have the house shingled. And they were from the tornado. They weren't from her house.
Wow. You know, the copies of the Worcester Telegram were found in Boston Harbor.
Oh.
An icebox of the House of Framingham was found on Blue Hill. Boards piercing sides of houses. So my point being is that we don't know the terror of a tornado. Imagine the Midwest, where you have literally have no time to react. And is that thunderhead? Is that going to turn into a tornado? We experienced horrific thunderstorms, but we've got it pretty good here in New England. We get blizzards, and of course, what do we do to blizzards? We go and buy milk and bread. Then that defends us against all blizzards. So does anybody else have any other comments on storms that they can recall, bad weather? Great. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you this morning. I don't think I'm going to speak about the year without a summer at this point.
Yes, yeah. There's still hope.
There is still hope. That's correct. That we may have a summer. And I think that this weather pattern where the jet stream is sitting over Boston and bringing us all this cloudy weather, we're now known as Seattle East. Gardens destroyed. All we can grow radishes and lettuce, but I think that you may see a change in the weather pattern for the near future.
Next week, I hope, because I'm going to be away.
Oh, are you going to be away?
Yeah.
Yeah, but,
I hope it's nice up there.
Well, we did have a good 4th of July weekend, didn't we, weather-wise?
It was nice
to
see.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's hit or miss, but rain is the sustenance of life. So thank you very much. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much, Reading.
Thank you.